If you find standing on your head the most effective posture to be mindful and aware, then I'd recommend standing on your head. No, seriously though, the point, there's two points. One is that it's when we're trying to develop any kind of contemplative skill, then we need to find what conditions are optimal for us in developing that skill. And some people do find that the walking practice is much more suited to their temperament and need than sitting. And sometimes it's the other way around. I actually prefer the sitting, to be quite honest. But in the bigger picture, the aim of the practice is not to become adept in one posture or another, but actually to bring this quality of attention into all postures. And in the end, to integrate it as much as one can into just the routines of your life. That's what really matters. I mean, if you can sit and walk and be totally attentive and aware and concentrated, that's great. But if that doesn't carry over into how you live, then, it's a nice experience when you're on retreat. But why do you go on retreat? Just to sort of escape from things? So I think you have to think of all of those aspects. But yes, it's important not to feel that there is a kind of privileged or right way of doing this practice that you have to master if your body or your temperament actually is more suited to other forms. You have to become, in a sense, your own. You have to become autonomous in this process. Oh, I want to record this. Okay. Yes.
First of all, thank you very much for stand.
No, please stand. Yeah.
Thank you very much for your talk. That was fascinating. I wanted to first ask you, where do views come into your scheme of things? Yeah, because they can be quite dangerous.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, that's a good question. And in fact, the Buddha has a rather, is somewhat ambivalent about the role of views. The word in Sanskrit or Pali is ditti. Ditti. And sometimes he considers ditti, views, opinions, to be very much part of the problem. And when we use this triad, greed, hatred, delusion is a little bit difficult to unpick, but certainly part of it is being preoccupied with views and opinions. So for example, the different ways we react, we might react by saying, yes, I want that, or no, I don't like that, I want to get rid of it, or we might react by saying, no, I don't agree with that, this is the true opinion, or we may find that the views are part and parcel of our habitual reactivity, and particularly in any kind of communication or discussion, or you're reading something or hearing something. What's interesting is to notice how your opinions about something often, in a sense, are triggered by what a politician might say. A politician of a party you don't approve of comes along and makes some statement, then immediately your reaction is, that's not true. So we have to recognize that views and opinions are often part of how we secure our identity in particularly social and other situations. And we are very invested in being right and having the right views of things. So clearly there we need to be very careful. And views of this nature are also highly insidious. We virtually anything can be turned into a restrictive opinion. Like Buddhism is supposed to liberate you from views and opinions, but over time you start becoming very attached to your Buddhist views and opinions. It's not easy to get out of that circle, because we crave certainty, we crave being right, we crave having that, you know, that conviction of it's a security issue. So on the one hand, yes, the Buddha calls it the thicket of views, the thicket of opinions. In other words, it's a sort of a trap. It's like being stuck in some jungle of your opinions and views, and you can't see anything else. They're blinding, they're obstructing. But then, the next thing you know, he talks about samadhiti, right view. Same word, that is the first step of the Eightfold Path. Right? So clearly ditti there is not seen as a problem at all. In fact, samadhiti, we don't have time to go into this now, but he has an awful lot to say about how the view in the broader sense of how we see the world and our role within it is crucial to how the rest of the path unfolds. And in fact, samadhiti, usually translated as right view, but again, samad doesn't actually mean right. That to me has way too strong a moralistic right versus wrong. A sama means something like complete or integrated. So samadhiti I translate as complete vision, complete view, if you wish, a kind of integrated view, which has to do with, in a sense, cultivating a way of seeing the world and seeing yourself in terms of, let's say, the transient nature of things, the dukkha aspect of things, anatta, shunyata. All of these are aspects of a way of seeing the world and yourself that are not limiting or constrictive, but provide you with the paradigm or the framework within which to have a more a more helpful way of seeing the world that enables you to, in a sense, disentangle yourself from opinions. But it's still called ditti. So clearly you can't live as a human being without having a certain view of things. The question is, how do we distinguish between views that are conducive to this sort of practice and these ethical ideals and views that stand and get in the way? So it's a tricky question, actually. It's not so straightforward.
Can I follow up?
Yeah. Well, that you could look at it that way. Yes.
It helps me.
If you find it, see, the point is, I don't want you to agree with me. I want you to think for yourselves. And all I'm sharing with you is my own process of study and reflection and inquiry. And I found that I found it helpful to look at things this way. But you see, the thing is, you can. Every morning I shave with Occam's razor. You know what Occam's razor is? If you can say something more economically than in some other way, then dispense with the non-economical way of saying it. In other words, if we can just talk about views and complete views, or right views if you wish, I don't think we have to muddy that water further by then introducing concepts of relative and ultimate truth. I think we're actually going off on a slightly different tangent there, although certainly, as you say, we're in the broad, you know, it could be seen that way. And in fact, that was in my Tibetan training, samadhiti, right view, we'll leave it at that, was in fact having a correct understanding of what constitutes ultimate truth. That is samadhiti. That's how Tsongkhapa and other Tibetan teachers would see it. Samaditi is understanding emptiness, for example. It's called Yandapidawa, correct view. But at the same time, also, relative views and opinions can be perfectly helpful too. They're not all problematic. In fact, it's very important, for example, in your work or in your life, you know, to be educated, to be learned, to have a clear understanding of what's going on. It's all relative stuff, if you like. But it's still useful. It's not wrong views. So there's not an exact overlap with the two. And I find it more helpful, really, to think of views that are conducive to the unfolding and the practice of the path, and views that are not conducive to that. I would find that a more economical way of working with views, and I don't see how adding relative, absolute, or terms like truth into the mix really help. I think you can do perfectly well without them, unless you can persuade me that that language is providing me with something that is otherwise missing. I prefer not to use it.
I wouldn't try to persuade you. It's just that the terms relative and absolute truth really rang bells with me.
In a positive way.
In a positive
way. Yeah. Okay. No, that's fine. Your experience is basically the only one you have.
With ditti, is there an aspect of a process rather than just a thing of opinions as this opinion, that opinion, the other opinion? Or is it more a way of seeing?
It's a good question. It's more a way of seeing. I'm going to see if I can find a text. Hang on. There's a text here which is called the Kacchanagota Sutta, in which the Buddha is actually asked, you know, what is samaditti? Do you want me to read his answer? So I don't have to actually, you don't have to listen to my views and opinions. I translate it here as Kacchanagota, we don't know who he is. He comes to the Buddha and he says, you say samaditti, complete vision. In what respects is vision complete? And this is the Buddha's answer. He says, by and large, Kacchana, this world relies on the duality of it is and it is not. But one who sees the arising of the world as it happens with complete understanding has no sense of it is not about the world. And one who sees the ceasing of the world as it happens with complete understanding has no sense of it is about the world. Now this is to me, this is my foundational text for understanding samaditti. In other words, as you point out, it doesn't have to do with holding an opinion about something. It has to do with, essentially, being suspicious of the inbuilt duality into the structure of language itself. It is and it is not, which in Aristotle is, you know, something either is A or it's not A. That's the law of the excluded middle. Now the Buddha is saying, as long as we understand the world, see the world in terms of either or, it is not, we are a long way from samaditti. Samaditti, complete vision, is recognizing that those primary categories of language are inadequate to represent the fluid and processual nature of experience. So in other words, if we see the arising of the world, in other words, something coming into existence, like a flower emerging, it's impossible to say it is not. But when we see the dying of something, the ceasing, fading away of something, it's no longer possible to say it is. In other words, it is and it is not, project onto the fabric of the process of life categories that may be useful in some... we couldn't speak without using these terms. But if we take them literally, and if we try to, if we fall for the fact that the world must somehow correspond to our language, then we're actually missing samaditi. We don't have a complete picture. That's why I like complete rather than right, apart from the fact that it's what the word literally means. So yes, it's more like that. It's more cultivating an attitude that is suspicious of taking words and concepts too literally and superimposing them onto the structure of experience. Yes?
What I was originally going to ask was about enlightenment. And do you see that as a process rather than a state?
Yes, totally.
And therefore, anybody who claims to be enlightened, it doesn't give them an authority per se. I suppose what I'm getting round to is that just because the Buddha said it doesn't necessarily mean it's true.
No, sure. Or it's attributed to the Buddha doesn't necessarily mean it's true. I don't like the word enlightenment because it is suggestive of a state that some people have and some people don't.
And you attain sort of.
You attain it. And I listen to conversations sometimes in which people say, is the Dalai Lama enlightened? Now that's a, and people take this terribly seriously. So it's something that could be somehow discussed and resolved. Frankly, those sorts of discussions are fairly meaningless unless you can unless you can answer another question: enlightened about what? That's the interesting question. Enlightened about what? Enlightenment does not exist as a condition sui generis in its own right, that some people have got it and other people don't. Anyone who comes along and says, I am enlightened, treat that with an enormous pinch of salt and ask them what they're enlightened about. That's the best answer, I think, because it forces you to recognize that, again, enlightenment we think of as a state or, let's say, a concept, and we believe instinctively, because we don't have samaditi, that that concept corresponds to some state of affairs in the world, in the lives of certain people, which corresponds to what we mean by enlightenment. So the Dalai Lama is enlightened, but George Bush isn't, or something. But that's a very crude way of thinking, and it doesn't stand up to much philosophical criticism. And yet this text here, for example, which interestingly is the only text that Nagarjuna cites as an authority for his philosophy, is this very text. This is the base of the whole philosophy of emptiness. In that sense, I prefer the word awakening, because by a happy coincidence, awakening in English can be both a gerundive noun and a verb. In other words, we can talk of awakening as a process of waking up. That, I think, is more useful rather than aspiring to some end state in which we're enlightened and all of our problems are solved and we don't have any suffering anymore. That's what Buddhism as a religion is proposing, that there is an end state that you can get to in which you will achieve some sort of perfection. I really don't find that very helpful. I find it much more useful to ask of myself, in this moment, can I respond to the situation in a more enlightened or awakened way than a less enlightened or awakened way? And the judgment has to really be in terms of my own ability to respond authentically or truly or helpfully, rather than to presuppose some enlightened state. We could go on and on, but that's broadly speaking where I would understand this.
Thank you.
Thank you. Yes.
This is more although you've got a comment, more possibly a not a victim of I was struck and interested by the way you took the first task as comprehending dukkha instead of being posited as a metaphysical truth. I like that as a challenge. And I like it that you translated as embracing. And you went back to the original Pali, which I didn't know about. But in classical Greek, many books were called about something, and this about, which in English also means around, we went about, was in Greek peri, which got translated, so periphuses on nature, got translated to English, not as about nature, a book about nature, but a book on nature, which is unfortunate. But the suffix survives in other English words like periphery, or peristaltic, or perihelion, or
pericope.
Perimeter.
Perimeter.
That which is around.
Yeah.
And I like it because, in a way, in a roundabout way, it survives in the English language, that there is an embracing of the topic. So in this case, another example that can be given, this embracing of dukkha does survive indirectly in the English language.
Well, you see, the word that's why I choose comprehend, because the Latin likewise, com means around also. It's inclusive. Prehendere, to apprehend or to grasp. And what would the Greek be? Peri, is there a peri something? Peri?
Peri, to comprehend.
Yeah. Perigmosis or?
It could be, I haven't heard it before.
Okay. But yeah, I think we can learn a lot by listening to the wisdom that is embedded in language itself, etymologically. But at the same time, we also need to find an idiom, a way of speaking that is not hyperliteral, but conveys what is arguably, you know, the term that best suits, you know, the particular practice that's involved. I'm not entirely happy with comprehend, even though it's literal. Other translators translate it as to fully know. Embracing is more idiomatic, and that's the term I prefer, because that also has the great advantage of holding it in your arms. It embodies it. It also has very much a much stronger affective connotation. You embrace another person. You can't embrace a person with hatred. It's always suggestive of love or care or compassion. You embrace the world. And so, yeah, I think embrace is probably the best word. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you. Really enjoyed the talks today. I found that you put very little emphasis on sense of love or kindness or compassion, although you did touch on it briefly. But, you know, for me, for instance, the idea of letting go of craving, just during my walking meditation, really, for me, it really had to be lovingly because otherwise, perhaps as a Westerner, perhaps as me, I instantly otherwise shift to
suppression. Yeah.
So, just wondering why perhaps today they were touched on lightly.
Well, it's probably. It's interesting you mentioned it, because I was actually trying to make a point of bringing that aspect in. I obviously failed dismally. This practice is one in which we learn to treat ourselves and others gently and caringly. That to me seems self-evident, and that's perhaps why I don't emphasize the point as much as might be necessary. I also feel that the love and compassion and kindness are more the results of living in this way, in a sense. I think if we could genuinely free ourselves from the entanglements of our egoism, of our fears, of our hatreds, of our cravings, that in itself would free us affectively, not just cognitively, to see things more clearly, but affectively in the sense of being able to empathize more fully with what others are experiencing. To me, a key term is empathy here. I think empathy is the necessary precondition for compassion and for love. And empathy, I think, is only possible when we have freed ourselves to some degree from what is from our non-empathetic behavior. In other words, our selfish, self-interested behaviors. But also, as you suggest, in dealing with oneself, again, I think we come from a culture, particularly a religious culture, that somehow considers the person to be somehow sort of intrinsically self-centered and so forth and so on, and thereby sets up a target that we need to somehow overcome. Buddhism has this kind of discourse as well at times. And that's actually simply, in a sense, we simply manifest a kind of aversion, which is a form of hatred or anger, in the name of wisdom or compassion. So we should be very careful that this process is not driven by the fact that we don't like something about ourselves, or we don't like something about others, and that we want to get rid of it, we want to suppress it. And see, I use the word letting go. This is very often translated as abandon. That is the common translation. Abandon craving, abandon reactivity. And I find it difficult not to think of abandoning something as a form of quite violent rejection. You know, if you abandon your dog on the street, you're not doing that with love and compassion. You're chucking it out. And I think particularly now that we understand these patterns of reactivity, like greed and hatred and so on, are part of our physiognomy, in a way. They're part of our limbic system. They're part of who we are. And you find passages in the Pali Canon which say that greed and hatred and so forth should be cut off like a palm stump, never to arise again. That's a phrase, it's a pericope, another Greek originating word with peri. Now, I find that language very violent. You cut these things off like a palm stump. In other words, you literally... now, that, I think, is not long... It no longer makes sense. In traditional Buddhist cultures, greed and hatred were seen to be purely mental properties. They come with you when you get reborn. They're part of your mental continuum. They're the negative inheritance from your past lives. And you therefore do meditation and other practices in order to cut that, to get rid of those mental processes altogether. But nowadays, I think it's very difficult for us to accept that greed and hatred, for example, are not deeply embedded in our biological evolution. They're part of us. So the idea of abandoning them or cutting them off like a palm stump would suggest, actually, that we should all go and have some lobotomy, some sort of surgical intervention to get rid of these bits of ourselves that we can't accept. So this parinya, this embracing, also has to do with accepting. It has to do with accepting our animal nature, if you wish, our conditioned nature, our human nature, and learning to work and relate to that in a way that respects it, but at the same time recognizes the limitations that are built into some of these behaviors, and seek ways to not identify with them. That's the key. This idea of letting go is not about destroying anything at all. It's letting it play itself out and not reinforcing or fueling it. But it's not about being angry with it or hating it or anything like that. Thank you. Yeah, au fond.
I find meditation very
healing.
Healing. Mm. Where I am, really.
Uh-huh.
Have you encountered in Buddhism that it actually can help a person who's clearly very delusional?
So who's clearly very delusional?
Yes. Paranoid, delusional. So beyond reality that they speak to you, and you know that what they're experiencing is not. Can't be true or is this reality, but for them it's absolutely real. It's and it, they're suffering with it.
Mm.
Is there any kind of more compassionate way than just giving them drugs to change the chemistry in the mind?
Well, I think. Well, you see, I think. I mean, I'm not a psychologist or a therapist, so.
Yeah, but you might have some experience. I don't know.
Well, I think when we talk about delusional, we're talking really of a spectrum. I think all of us are probably deluded to some degree, and I think it's probably not an accident the Buddha uses this word that we translate as delusion. We're deluded about, we think that we're permanent, for example. That's probably a delusion. But then, of course, there are other forms of delusion which are clearly pathological. Which would require probably some sort of therapeutic intervention which would go beyond, you know, just doing Buddhist meditation. But again, I think it's striking how mindfulness, which is the practice we've been doing here, and which I think is very, very much at the core of the Buddha's Dhamma, is now being utilized in healthcare to treat all kinds of conditions. Now, there are people in this room who know a lot more about this than I do, so I don't want to make any exaggerated claims, and I think we have to be cautious in saying mindfulness is a solution to the world's problems. It's probably not. But I do think, and there does seem to be a considerable body of evidence now that shows how mindfulness-based interventions, whether in paranoid delusion, I don't know whether that would work or not, I don't know if that's been... it's been used in that context, but certainly in many other kinds of contexts which would have delusional elements, yes, if we can become more, if we can begin to relate to our experience with a greater degree of detachment, perhaps with a greater degree of a kind of ironic self-awareness, a greater degree of stillness, we'll be in a much more I think much more effective position to really be able to tease apart what is fictitious or delusional in our understanding and what is not. So I would think it probably could be utilized, but I wouldn't want to make a generalized statement. But going back to your initial point, the Buddha himself described the Dharma as therapy. He described himself as a healer, as a doctor, as a physician. He saw the Dhamma as a course of medical treatment. He saw the community as the Sangha as nursing staff. So he was very much aware of how his teaching was comparable to a medical treatment. And he saw the human condition as basically in a state of... that we're all basically unwell. We're existentially unwell, in a sense. And he sees the Dhamma as a way of healing that deep unwellness or sickness, if you wish, that affects all of us to some degree. So it's really a question of degree and to what extent these practices can be extended beyond the common existential condition of humanity into specific pathological areas. And it is now being shown to be the case. So yeah, that's how I would see that.
So where does that occur in the suttas? The reference to Buddha saying...
I can't give you chapter and verse. It's certainly there. Well, take for example, drop me a line, or just Google it, and you'll probably find there are many, many references. And not only is the Buddha using it metaphorically, he shows in his discourses a considerable knowledge of the medical traditions of his time. Go to the Sunakata Sutta, which I think is Majjhima 50. The Sunakata Sutta. It's a discourse to a man called Sunakata. And there he describes the process of working with craving, removing the arrow of reactivity, in very precise medical language. He talks of mindfulness as a kind of probe And he talks of intelligence or understanding as a surgical knife. And he talks of the need that once you've done the surgery, you need to take care of the wound and dress it and treat it. There's very strong medical metaphors running through the canon. There's even passages where the Buddha is seen to actually, you know, physically intervene in the treatment of an ill person who's not being taken care of. In fact, there's a wonderful statement in the Vinaya where the Buddha says, whoever would tend to me should tend to the sick. So that's, again, it's a bit like Matthew 25, actually. The person who cares for the Dhamma or the Buddha's teaching should care for the sick. Not just metaphorically sick, but the actual sick. So I address this in my next book, actually. So there's a whole chapter there on the Buddha's doctor called Jivaka, and I explore this in some detail. In America in the autumn, in Britain in January, but you can probably get it through Amazon. Yes.
I was just thinking about how, just listening to you today, that the sutta that we're talking about sort of has always seemed to me like first principles, because I think if you go take a course, it's one of the first things you learn, mm-hmm. Four Noble Truths. Mm-hmm. Today it sounded like what you were saying in terms of the 12 tasks, more of the entire prescription. And I was really struck by the kind of elegance of that and how beautifully, it's language, if I can say it that way. I just wondered if you could tell us a little bit about how this stuff got written down. Because I have a sort of a view of him walking around and talking and maybe perfecting what he was saying. And yet, to have it written down so elegantly is actually really striking. And I just wondered, how did those kind of key sutras get written down? How long was the gap? And who,
It's a huge question. It's a very good question. Briefly, yeah. Where do we begin? One thing that scholars have now got a fairly good rough idea of at least basic layers within the Pali Canon. And the earliest layers, which are found in texts like the Sutta Nipata, don't mention the Four Noble Truths at all, or the Four Tasks, or any of this stuff. So it's possible that this model of four truths, tasks, I would argue for tasks, came along, was not actually the very first thing the Buddha taught. That is possible. If we look at the different strata within the canon itself. But what's striking about the Buddha's first what we call the Buddha's first discourse, is that it is clearly a text that has been worked and reworked and reworked and reworked and reworked. It's very economical, which is not the general thing you say about Buddhist suttas. They tend to be rambling, long-winded, repetitive, weirdly structured. The first sermon is highly refined. It's clearly been thought about and worked upon for a long time. Now, whether it reached the form in which we have it now during the Buddha's lifetime or at some point after, it's not actually possible to say. We don't know. All that we do know, with any degree of certainty, is that the canon, largely speaking what is preserved in Pali today, was written down in about 80 BC in Sri Lanka, in Ceylon, which is about 300 years after the Buddha died. So there's a period of about 300 years in which the canon was presumably was evolving in some ways. And I don't think writing it down is somehow as definitive as we in a literate culture ascribe it to be. It's only when it gets written down that we can trust it. I think these ancient cultures, not just Buddhist, but for example the Vedas, the Upanishads, are much older, and they weren't written down for much, much longer periods of time. In other words, oral cultures had as much concern to preserve their literature, their teachings, their culture, as we do by writing everything down. And so orality, I think we have to think of as possibly more reliable as a means of transmitting culture than we would tend to think it to be in a literate time like our own. So I don't have any difficulty with the first discourse, for example. Let's say it was discussed during the Buddha's lifetime, it was worked up to a certain point, and possibly in the decades or longer after the Buddha's life, it kept being tinkered with a bit. And I've already said that it's likely that the words noble truth were plugged in at a later date. You can see that, you know, by fairly simply looking at the syntax of the text. So clearly that came along at some point later, but did it happen during the Buddha's lifetime? Did it happen a few years later or a century later? It's impossible to say. But by 80 BC, it seems likely that the text that we now have in the Pali Canon had more or less reached the form that we now know. One last question.
Thank you. You gave a very useful understanding of some core fundamentals, but one thing which I felt I would like to hear your thoughts on, which I felt you didn't touch on, was ideas of the self. I know you have separated metaphysics from ethical practice.
Yeah.
My impression has been that in more traditional readings and Buddhist understanding, actually the idea or the concept of self is a sort of a fundamental bridge between the two,
Well, non-self, you see, this is problematic. The word is anatta, which translators now agree upon largely as, in English, not self. There's no sense that the Buddha said there is no self. A lot of Buddhist orthodoxy often say that, and a lot of literature in English suggests that there's a body, a mind, feelings, inclinations, consciousness, but there's no self. That's Theravada orthodoxy. That comes about 1,000 years after the Buddha. Let me just give you a couple of examples and then we'll conclude. If you look at verse number 80 in the Dhammapada, the Buddha says, just as a farmer irrigates a field, just as an arrowsmith fashions an arrow, just as a carpenter shapes a block of wood, so the wise person tames the self. Now, the word is atta, the same as in anatta. And in this example, self is clearly not being rejected as non-existent or illusory or fictional. But self is actually what we work with. It is the raw materials of our practice. And it's compared to a barren field, the pieces of an arrow that are yet to be put together, to an uncarved block of wood. And the practice is actually to constitute, to irrigate, to shape and fashion who we are, ourselves, our persons, our individuality. One of the Buddha's last statements is, be an island to yourself. Same word, atta. Be an island. Yourself is your refuge. Yourself is an island. Yourself is a lamp. So clearly there's no dismissing or rejecting the notion of self. In fact, self is understood to be an utterly integral part of what it means to be human. But what the Buddha's, in a sense, pointing to is that there's no such thing as a permanent self. There's no some fixed essence or entity that corresponds to who you really are. In fact, he's saying you are a process. You are a transient set of conditions that can be fashioned and shaped through this practice of these different tasks. In other words, he's actually talking about what we might today call a process of individuation, actually. And finally, I think to sort of settle this matter, is a dialogue with Vachagota, who's a non-Buddhist mendicant or wanderer, and Vajragotī comes to the Buddha and he says, is there a self? And the Buddha remains silent. And then Vajragotī says, okay then, is there not a self? And the Buddha remains silent. And then Vajragotī stands up and walks away. He's not happy with that. And then Ānanda, the Buddha's attendant, asks, why didn't you tell him something? Why didn't you answer him? And the Buddha said, if I had said, there is a self, then he would have slipped into the dead end of eternalism. He would have thought of himself as permanent. And if I had said, there is not a self, he would have fallen into the dead end of nihilism. So in other words, this goes back to the Samaditti passage we were looking at. It's the same two words, it is not. And he's basically saying that the self is a process, a fluid, evolving, changing, adapting process that is not reducible to the simplistic categories of it is and it is not, exists or does not exist. Buddhism as a metaphysical system tended to opt for the self being non-existent, or ultimately non-existent, relatively existent. This is how they get around the problem. They again adopt this two truth language. But actually, when you go to the early suttas, it's clear the Buddha is not demonizing the self. He certainly sees the problems about selfishness, about self-centeredness, about only thinking of yourself, of being narcissistically preoccupied with me. He definitely sees that as a problem. But to reject all notions of self, to get into some selfless state, would be going way too far.